Welcome to another edition of the Health First Show. I'm your host, Dave Fuller, and today we're going to be talking about, we're going to be talking with Holly Belabono about her book, Woman Healers of the World. In the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about allergies and families. Before we do that, here's Rich with the health news.
Eating a low-carb, high-fat diet could help control epilepsy that is difficult to treat, according to new research. A review of five studies found a ketogenic or modified Atkins diet that focuses on foods like bacon, eggs, heavy cream, butter, fish, and green vegetables could help reduce seizures in adults whose condition doesn't improve with medication. In conducting the review, the researchers analyzed five studies on the ketogenic diet involving 47 people. The researchers also reviewed five more studies on the modified Atkins diet, which included 85 people. The researchers found 32% of the patients on the ketogenic diet and 29% of those following the modified Atkins diet had reduction in their seizures by 50% or more. Meanwhile, 9% of those in the ketogenic diet and 5% in the modified Atkins group had drops in their seizures by 90% or more, according to the study published online October 29th in Neurology. A new study reports drinking a lot of milk could be bad for your health. Previous research has shown the calcium in milk can help strengthen bones and prevent osteoporosis. These benefits to bone health have led U.S. health officials to recommend milk as part of a healthy diet. But this new study found drinking large amounts of milk did not protect men or women from bone fractures and was linked to an overall higher risk of death during the study period. However, the researchers say the results should be viewed with caution. The researchers found women who drank three glasses of milk or more every day had a nearly double risk of death and cardiovascular disease and a 44% increased risk of cancer compared to women who drank less than one glass per day. Men's overall risk of death increased by 10% when they drank three or more glasses of milk daily, says the study, published online October 28th in BMJ. Exposure to a common plastics chemical during pregnancy may have effects on genital development in baby boys, a small study hints. Researchers found baby boys born to mums with greater exposure to a chemical called DINP tended to have a shorter anagenital distance, the space between the genitals and anus. Anagenital distance is set in the womb, and it's considered a marker of male hormones during pregnancy. The researchers say their findings, published online October 29th in Environmental Health Perspectives, add to concerns about the possible effects of certain plasticizers on the male reproductive system. And finally, new research suggests as many as 1 in 20 U.S. children may have health or behavioral problems related to alcohol exposure before birth. The study found between 2.4% and 4.8% of children have some kind of fetal alcohol syndrome disorder, or FASD. The study's lead researcher says the high prevalence of children affected by drinking during pregnancy may be due to social pressures or women's difficulty in changing their drinking habits. Findings from the study were reported online October 27th and in the November print issue of Pediatrics.
Thanks for that, Reg. Well, our first guest, Holly Belabono, is one of North America's most popular herbalists. She's written a number of books, including her latest, Woman Healers of the World. Holly, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks to be here, Dave. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in herbs. And you, I understand you spent 7 years traveling around the world in researching this book and your other, you know. Tell us a little bit, how you got interested in that, what happened.
I've always been interested in plants, and about 20 years ago, to pay my way through graduate school, started working on a landscaping crew and as a gardener. Really just did it for the chance to be outside and make money at the same time, and it turned out to be a great education. I learned not only that plants like wildflowers and weeds could be edible, but also that they could be medicinal, and that really started a love affair with plants, and went on from there to study herbal medicine and to teach herbal medicine. I run an herb school now. But along the way, I also realized how important it was to celebrate the heritage of herbal medicine, not just the plants themselves, but the people who share this knowledge with other people and keep the information going. And it became clear that a lot of these people were women, and they really weren't getting their credit that I thought they deserved in science and research and literature. So I wrote this book to celebrate these women and to make people aware that this is such a fantastic heritage, this tradition of working with plants to heal people, and that it's a world tradition that is different in every culture and fascinating, but it comes from a common core of respect for the plants and appreciating that connection that you can get with nature.
You know, you talked about heritage, and you talked about, you know, sharing the knowledge through the generations. Is that typically something that is more, you know, in your work? Have you found that, you know, women tend to do it more than men?
Maybe. There are a lot of great men herbalists out there. There really are. But women tend to be the hearth keepers, for lack of a better word. We tend to raise the children, and the people who are raising the children are the ones who are sharing the stories. So kids get raised with the ideas that their mothers grow up with. Those ideas are passed on, and I think the women that are passing along these traditions of medicine and healing and science and botany, these are great stories that children really need to hear, you know, and it's not that they're stories that are fictitious. You know, we're not talking about fairy tales and that sort of thing. We're talking about women who have really contributed to science in the past as well as in the present. Some of the women that I interviewed, I interviewed 21 women who are alive today, everything from midwives to nurses to pharmacists to alternative healers. And I also feature 10 historic women. So these are people whose reach goes back a long way, and they've really been influencing medicine for, in some cases, more than 3,000 years, going back to Hatshepsut in Egypt. Really fascinating story. So I think it's great that women in particular are keeping this alive.
Holly, I'm just wondering if you can give us some examples of perhaps women that, you know, that you were going, you know, as you were traveling, that you were really surprised of. Maybe tell us the context of, you know, where they were and, you know, what they shared with you that really made a difference for their community.
Yeah, so one woman that I had the chance to meet with in Hawaii, Auntie Velma de la Pena, she's a kahuna, which is a healer, and also a kapuna, which is an elder, and she's a great-grandmother. She practices the traditional Polynesian forms of medicine, which include la'au lapa'au, which is herbal medicine, which is what I'm really interested in. But she also practices a lot of the other traditional forms, such as lomi lomi, which is massage, and ho'oponopono, which is a form of mediation or community counseling. She was a really wonderful woman to speak with because she's so gentle and so dedicated to preserving the traditions of her heritage, not only in herbal medicine, but Hawaiian tradition in general, because in her lifetime, she saw the resurgence of Hawaiian heritage and the legalization of the Hawaiian language, because it wasn't always legal to speak Hawaiian, and she saw a lot of that come back. So she's a very big trumpeter for, you know, keeping those traditions alive and educating people on what has happened in the past so that you don't make the same mistakes in the future. Mm-hmm. Another lady that I spoke with was in Peru, right outside Cusco, Peru. Her name was Mauna Kea Ingenlath. She was known as Mauna Kea because she rescued Peruvian children from the streets and brought them in. These were orphans who were in danger of malnutrition and violence because they had nowhere to go. So she brought them into her home, but instead of running it as an orphanage, she adopted them all herself and just created a huge home and family. So when I spoke with her, she had more than 35 children.
Wow.
And was raising them as her own and doing a really great job of it, teaching them their own traditional native traditions of dance and music and song and art, and also herbs, how to heal themselves with calendula and mint, you know, really basic folk medicine, giving them the tools that they need to really be able to take care of themselves and be self-sufficient. So she was a great inspiration.
Now, you talk with a Moroccan chemist.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about her.
Her name is Dr. Zubida Sharouf, and she is in Morocco when she was years ago, when she was going to get her PhD, in science. She decided to focus on the Argan tree, which is the country's native tree. And she was just writing about it botanically from a botany perspective. But every day on her way to the university, she would pass women along the side of the road. One woman here, a half mile down, another woman. And these women were selling oil in chipped jars and chipped bottles, and they were all by themselves, and they didn't look very successful. And she came to realize that they were selling argan oil, which was made from the nut of the tree that she happened to be studying. And she stopped, and she talked to these different women, and she realized that they were just, that's how they were making money. And they didn't really have a business plan. They'd never been trained. They had no education. And so she decided to form a cooperative. So she brought hundreds and hundreds of women together and trained them, provided different sorts of business models and also equipment to help press the nuts better so they could extract more oil from them. And now argan oil is one of the top cosmetic oils sold in Europe. It's in great demand. And it's also leading to a resurgence of saving the argan trees that were at risk. Now they're being planted widely, and a lot of it is due to Zubeda Sharif and her vision of helping these women.
Well, I noticed that argan oil is actually becoming popular in North America, and I'm wondering, what is it used for?
So far, it's been used as a cosmetic oil, so people will use it topically in makeup and shampoos and face creams, that sort of thing. Very nourishing, very rich. I haven't heard it used too much as an edible oil. So far, I've seen it in cosmetics.
So does it have healing properties for the skin?
I believe so. I'm not an expert on argan oil in particular. If it's like many of our other oils that are gotten from nuts and seeds, then yes, you know, it's got the vitamin E, it's got the omega fatty acids, very hydrating. These sorts of oils, they form a good barrier on the skin to help with, you know, dry, itchy patches like psoriasis and things like that. So yeah, very, very nourishing. And in the case of these women, it's a moneymaker. You know, they're able to support their families now.
Tell us a little bit about the Gaelic herbs that, you know, you did some research on them. What is the story behind them, and what are some of the herbs that are useful today?
So she was a fascinating lady. Her name was Mary Beath. She passed away a couple of years ago. She was a chronicler of Gaelic pharmacy. She's one of the women who I found because I just shared my story, and someone said, hey, have you met this woman? Do you know her? She lives in Scotland. She records the old practices, the old folk healing arts of Gaelic pharmacy. So I got in touch with Mary, and I found out that she had been doing this for a long time, pulling in stories and researching ancient traditions from around the country in collaboration with local universities to create kind of a database of this ancient knowledge, because she was afraid it was going to be lost. She's one of the few people who's really taken the initiative to record it. And what she found was, it was pretty fascinating to me. It's kind of, especially for me, I come from Asheville, North Carolina, which has a very strong Scotch-Irish heritage and a lot of folk medicine that seems to me to be very superstitious. You know, some of the old-time folk medicine where, for instance, if you cut yourself, people used to, instead of rubbing an ointment on your skin, you would put the ointment on the knife. That sort of, you know, interesting kind of superstitious. She had a lot of that, but she also found that a lot of the folk methods in Gaelic pharmacy were very spiritual-based or spirit-based, because there was a strong belief in pixies and elves and sprites and goblins, people who, and entities that could take away your health or that could literally steal your children. And so a lot of the medicine was based on protecting yourself from these supernatural entities. They also used, in addition to the plants, such as sphagnum moss, as bandaging, they used animal parts. So she discovered that a lot of Gaelic pharmacy remedies included spiders and mice, in addition to the plants and their chemistry and their pharmacology.
We're talking with Holly Bilobono, and she has written a book called Woman Healers of the World. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be finding out more about some interesting herbs that can make a difference in your life.